evening.
Christy B. from San Diego.
Well, I'm Christy. I'm an alcoholic.
Get
the water ready. Thank you. My sobriety date is May 21st, 1994. It was the first time I went to a meeting. I haven't had to take a drink since. Up until that point, had done a lot of hard drinking, 10 years of hard drinking by the time I got to my first AA meeting. I got sober in Phoenix, Arizona. That's where I did all my drinking. I was born there. I come from an alcoholic family, both sides 100 years back. So when they say the alcoholic life became a normal one, that was normal living in my family for generations. My dad was what you would call a functioning alcoholic in his mind. He went to work. He didn't beat us. He was good. He came from a very abusive family, just a lot of trouble. And my mom and him met. My grandfather, my mom's dad, was retired World War II vet. So he was kind of a stern. He was a sergeant, kind of a stern man. And my mom and her sisters were raised in the 60s, so of course they rebelled. And she ended up meeting my dad, who was in the Air Force, and got pregnant with me and got married. And off to Vietnam my dad went. And when he came home, the way she always said it was he was never the same. And he had already attempted suicide before that, so his disease was already going. But what I remember about my home, and I talk about my home a little bit before I get into my story, is my dad rolled, when I was with him, my dad rolled with either a beer or a glass of tequila, a cigarette, and a joint. And that is how he just went through his day. It was more that way when my mom wasn't around. My mom was a school teacher. She didn't really know anything about drugs and alcohol. Her sister was an alcoholic, raging alcoholic. So my parents were 20 when they had me, and there were really no other kids around. And I was just around a lot of parties. I remember going to, we would go to Rocky Point. That's what you do in Arizona. You get to the beach, you go to Mexico, you go to Rocky Point. And I was 3, and we went to Rocky Point with my mom and my dad and my mom's sisters and their friends. And, you know, my aunt's boyfriend was giving me sips of tequila and letting me eat the lemon peels at 3. And that's just the way it was, you know. Like, there was nothing wrong with that. And there was, in my family, there was nothing wrong with, like, sipping off the beer, you know. I don't consider that my first drunk or my first drink. I actually smoked my first cigarette when I was 4. Because I'll tell you why. I was just a budding little alcoholic, you know, because I wanted to fit in. And my babysitter was 14 and I was 4, and she pulled out a cigarette and was smoking a cigarette, and I said, "Oh, I know how to smoke." And I ran into my bedroom and got my candy cigarettes. You guys remember those candy cigarettes? Yeah. Puff on the end. And I went and I sat down, and I mean, I loved everything about what you weren't supposed to do at 4 years old, you know. I loved that my dad smoked, and I loved the ladies that would smoke outside the Kmart, you know, and they'd be, you know, at 4, they'd be skinny, you know, smoking. And I, at 4 years old, I realized, like, I remember telling my mom and my aunt, seeing this gorgeous, she had dark hair, though, she had long, like, Peggy Lipton style 1970s hair, you know, smoking those long cigarettes. And I said, "Oh, when I grow up, I'm going to be just like her. And I'm going to smoke just like her so I can be skinny." That's what I wanted. That's 4. So I pulled out my candy cigarette, and my babysitter, she didn't, you know, she said, "You don't know how to smoke." I said, "Yeah, watch." You know, she goes, "Well, you need to smoke a real cigarette." And she gave me the real cigarette and lit the end, and I coughed and was, you know, and that was it, you know. But that was just kind of how I lived. And I always wanted to fit in. Everybody was always older than me. I would always lie and say I knew stuff that I didn't know. "Oh, yeah, I know all about Coke," you know, and I knew nothing. Or, "Oh, yeah, I know all about that," and I knew nothing. And it got me into a lot of trouble. I grew up in, and my parents lived a few doors down from my grandparents until I was five, and then we moved. We lived in Glendale. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Arizona, but Glendale at the time when I was little was like a little farming area. Actually, it was surrounded by orange groves and onion fields and horses and farmhouses, and we moved to Maryvale, which was a little bit further south. And I went to elementary school there, and over the years of living there, the neighborhood really started going down further and further into crime and drugs. And most of my street that I lived on, the kids were out smoking on the street and smoking weed. I mean, it's just that was the neighborhood. And a lot of the families started moving out, and we didn't. We stayed there, and my dad continued to drink. And, you know, I started getting rebellious at about 12 years old. And the first time I actually did anything, I smoked cigarettes and I smoked pot first before I actually took my first drink. And the student council president of my sixth grade, who was also my boyfriend, just gave me a joint outside this, you know, class and after school, and everybody went home. And I realized what my dad had been smoking. He had told me they were homemade cigarettes, you know. And we got really high, and we lost track of time. Imagine that, you know. And I wandered home at night. No one came looking for me, by the way, either. That's just kind of what happened. You know, I've always looked back like, did anybody come looking for me? It was like the hood, and I walked home by myself, and I was 12. And but when I walked in the door, my parents were like freaked out that I had not come home and was defying them. And I got that courage from being high, and I told my dad, I'm not going to cuss because I'm being recorded. I said, F you. And he slapped me across the face, and, you know, it just began, like the fighting with my parents began. And my parents had been fighting since the day I was born. They never really got along. So they took me to a counselor. And they decided that I was the problem. They took me to the counselor. And the counselor actually told them, she is not the problem. She's reacting to a life in alcoholism. And it was the first time, like, my mom and dad actually had heard that word. My mom kind of grabbed onto it, and he suggested that my mom go to Al-Anon. So she went to Al-Anon for a little while, and things actually got kind of good for me. Like, they got off my back, you know. My dad didn't quit drinking. He continued on drinking. And when I was 13, you know, it was a big showdown between my parents. But I want to say before that, because we were talking about this, I want to say thank you to all my Friday night girls for coming here tonight, too, before I get going. I go to a Friday night women's meeting, and they're like my girls, you know. And the bunch of you guys showed up, so I'm so glad that you're here tonight. And thank you for your story, too. I really appreciate it. We are real miracles here when we get sober, and you really were an example of that in your story. You know, we were talking before the meeting how I learned really young how to stuff everything down. And I, you know, in my sobriety, I'd like to go back and figure out where that came from. You know, it could be alcoholism. I grew up with a bunch of people who had been in war veterans, you know. My grandpa never talked about anything that happened in World War. He was in a lot of battles, I've come to realize, 1st Armored Division. He didn't talk about them until he was dying. And you push stuff down. And so by the time I took my first drink, I couldn't hold some of that stuff down without help anymore. And when my parents, like, exploded and we moved in further into the hood, that was it. I knew what to do. I knew what to reach for. Oh, also, I had had cousins coming to live with me. I have to talk about my cousins. My mother was untreated Al-Anon, so she'd have all the alcoholic cousins come live with us who needed her help. And the first one that came to live with us, he actually went to the Freedom Ranch, too. So I'm familiar with the Freedom Ranch. But he came to live with me. I was 5. He was 15. He was just budding alcoholic. You know, he was getting in all kinds of trouble with drinking, and they thought it was a good idea that he babysat me all summer. You know, so I'd hang out, and then the next cousin would come, and, you know, and she taught me all about men, you know, and I was like, you know, 8, and she's like 15, and she was teaching. I mean, it's like craziness. My cousin who went through the Freedom Ranch did not stay sober. He's in jail today for drugs and alcohol. And the other cousin that came died in a car wreck with her baby daughter trying to go into town to drink in Alaska. So I know where this disease takes us, you know. And actually, when I think about them, they're real gifts now to me to know, like, what happens. You know, they were a little bit ahead of me, so where I know, like, if I pick up, those are my options. So I took my first drink. I'll get to my first drink so I can get to sobriety, because I can get stuck in when I'm a little kid, and that's no fun. Well, once again, I wanted to fit in, and we had moved to this apartment complex, and it was not a good neighborhood at all, and I was pissed that we had moved, and I had started kind of smoking pot on a regular basis, but I hadn't really drank yet, and I was, there was a guy that was a year older than me. I was in eighth grade, just started eighth grade. He was a freshman, and his parents had split too, and they were, his dad was living in the apartment complex, and he invited me to come over and hang out. Well, his dad bought the kids booze. So his dad went and bought us a whole bunch of beer and let us all sit and smoke weed there at their apartment. Well, that was awesome. You know, like my dad drank, but he didn't like go here. You know, if I snuck it, he wouldn't care, but he wouldn't openly do it, at least not yet. And that came in a couple of years. But, you know, so I didn't know how to drink. I didn't know. I really didn't know other than sipping a little bit. I had never really gotten drunk that I could remember. And so I took a tumbler, half beer, half Jim Beam. That was the reaction that they had, too. And I said, oh, yeah, I know how to drink. And I downed it. And about 20 minutes later, you know, my mom came knocking on the door because I was supposed to babysit my little brother, who was 3 at the time. I was 13. And I got up and could not walk. And they were upstairs. I couldn't walk down the stairs. I threw up all over her. I actually had pretty severe alcohol poisoning. And she said, what is wrong with you? I said, I ate a rotten bologna sandwich. That was good for her. And home we went. And I called up. And now here's where I know I'm alcoholic. Because I think a non-alcoholic would go, I'm not going to go do that again. I couldn't wait to go back the next weekend. I called up my girlfriend. I said, hey, you got to come hang out at my house next Friday. You know, and the stoner look was in, you know, where I lived. And it was like concert T-shirts, Iron Maiden concert T-shirts, you know, long hair and the moccasin boots and the flannels. You know, we got all dressed up. And and went over there to smoke some more weed and to drink some more. And their dad did the same thing. He bought us a bottle of Jim Beam and gave us some, let us smoke. I don't know where they got the weed, but I'm assuming he had it. And then some beer and left us. That night, him and his girlfriend decided to leave. And so it was me and my girlfriend and these brothers and their stepbrothers. And we started playing quarters. And I had a kind of a crush on one of them. I thought he was really cute. So I was like trying to get him to like me. And, you know, I'm probably talking a bunch of crap because that's what I would do. And I'm thinking I'm bigger than I am. My grandmother always told me, you are too big for your britches. Too big for your britches. And that's just how I always was. My personality was that way. And I don't know how many shots I did, but they deliberately were putting more shots on me. And when I went to stand up, I could not stand, and they dragged me into the bedroom and assaulted me and assaulted my girlfriend. And my first reaction was, don't tell anybody. I did not want anyone to know. And I knew that I could turn to I just turned to booze every day. And from that day on, I was drinking or I was getting high. Period. Like, there was not a day that would go by for the next 2 years that I wasn't doing something. I was student council president of eighth grade. I was doing really good in school. And from that day, within 2 weeks, I was completely not even involved anymore. I'd just come to school high. I don't know why teachers didn't ever turn it in but me in, but it's the hood. You know, you just didn't do that there. You know, it was like I was just a bad kid in their eyes. Continued on in high school, barely passed high school. I only went to dance. That was the only class I cared about. And if it had anything to do with music, I was super into music, I'd go to that, but that was it. How I graduated, really my mom helped me. She was a high school teacher. She pulled us out of that area, moved us to a little nicer area of town, put me into high school where it wasn't so cool anymore to do drugs. The high school I originally was just too cool to do drugs. And at about 16, I mean, and well, I'll just touch into those 2 years for a little bit. I found, my mom had pretty much like freaked out over the divorce and was not around for 2 years. She gave me a bed, she gave me food and a house to sleep in if I wanted it. But other than being there, she had no idea. I hooked up with this drug dealer family that basically did a lot of coke. They dealt coke, and I was freebasing cocaine and snorting cocaine and doing acid, and I was 14 years old, and I was doing pretty much everything you could imagine. I looked about the same size I do today at 14, so I could lie and say, oh, no, I'm 18, you know, or whatever, but I was 14, you know, and so I just pretended like I was older than I was. At 16 years old, I had my first spiritual awakening, and one of the brothers of that family died. And in a car accident, he was one of the drug dealers. I was very close to him. And I really had a spiritual experience. Like, I really started hearing, like, I have got to stop this life. I'm going to die if I continue on like this. And I started trying to quit drinking. I really thought it would be easy. I really thought I could just go back to the life I had before that day when I was 13, when those boys assaulted me, and I could just become like a cheerleader again, and I could just become like play volleyball and do all the things I did before that happened. I attempted that, and then I'd find the girl on the cheer team that liked to do crystal meth, and then we'd do crystal meth, no kidding. And now when I read back, I mean, I just can't even believe some of the things I lived through, some of this stuff, but you know, I could not go longer than a few weeks without, because what would happen on the inside for me is all those hurts, all those things that I stuffed down, booze kept down, drugs kept down, a good boyfriend could keep down for a little while and it lasts too long, but didn't work as well as drugs, I don't know, and alcohol. And so as soon as I didn't have anything in me, that gaping feeling would just start to hurt too much. And so drinking really never was the problem for me. It was being sober that was the problem. And my dad had the same problem. I watched it my whole life. He would try to quit drinking. And man, I'll tell you, he was so miserable. He's miserable to be around. He hurt. We would almost be handing him a drink just so that everybody could feel better. And as soon as he took a drink, music came on, let's have fun. That was the kind of drinking I did because I could not stand being sober. And I had no idea that was happening. So I'd go through the next 7 years, I went through trying to quit. And I'll get to the year before I got sober. You know, I was going to Arizona State University, which is a huge party school, and I was failing out. My dad worked for ASU, so he would call me and say he was my drinking buddy by this time. All right, you're failing all these classes. Do you want your mom to find out? So I'd run in and I'd drop all these classes so that I would not look like I was failing out of college. And I'd tell myself every semester, this time I'm going to do it. I'm going to get a different degree because it was always the degree. And I'm going to go to school. I'm going to do it like everybody else. I couldn't figure out how everybody else was like doing school or like graduating, you know, like, or I just couldn't figure out how other people were paying rent. You know, my grandmother gave me money for rent all the time. She gave me my cars. You know, I just couldn't, I could not live. I didn't know how to do anything. So I was going to ASU. Me and my girlfriend decided we would try to quit drinking together. She was my friend who would say when we'd go out, okay, don't let me go home with anyone and don't let me do any coke. And I'd be like, oh, well, I'm doing the same thing. Like, what do you mean? So we decided we were quitting together. We were going to join the gym and that's what we were going to do. Because we want to look good. You know, and I'm going to quit smoking too. Oh, yeah, I got to quit smoking. I'm going to just get really fit. And so alcoholic, right? So we were going to the gym and I think it was like a couple weeks before Memorial Day weekend. And my group of friends all went to Mexico. We had switched from Rocky Point to El Golfo, which was a little different area, smaller town. We didn't like all the people at Rocky Point anymore. So we went to a smaller town, and it was just a drinking fest. Like, we just went to drink, ride these motorcycles like maniacs, and almost kill ourselves. And so I said I wasn't going because I quit drinking. Not taking a trip, taking a trip. That was huge for me when I got sober to see how alcoholic I was. I knew if I went on this trip, I would not be able to not drink. So I told them I couldn't go, I couldn't go. And I got call after call after call. You gotta go, you gotta go, you gotta go. And some of my girlfriends really wanted to go. So at like 4 a.m, I was like, fine, I'll go. I seriously packed so much, so alcoholic when I think about it, so much non-alcoholic stuff. I had sodas, diet sodas, orange juice, water. I was not drinking. And I packed it into this guy's car, his friend of mine's car. He had like a 1965 Mustang. We got in the car. We started heading to the border. They were drinking and driving. So he had drank a few beers. I kind of started freaking out. He's driving like a maniac, passing cars. I'm like, screw it, give me a beer. And everybody's like, yay, you know. What would happen, though, for me is, like, I would quit like that, and then I'd pick up, and then I had a pattern. I didn't know this till I got sober, but the pattern was I'd start drinking, I'd start looking for a boyfriend. Looking for someone, usually a drug dealer, that was going to fill that part of my life. And so when I got to the beach in Mexico, of course, you know, I'd quit smoking. So there was one guy smoking cigarettes. And, okay, I have to tell you, I was really into music. So almost all my boyfriends fit the pattern of some kind of musician. Like the first boyfriend was like Eddie Van Halen look-alike because Van Halen was really popular then. And at this point in time, the Stone Temple Pilots were really popular. And so this guy looked just like the lead singer of Stone Temple Pilots, smoking cigarettes on the beach. And, well, he became my new boyfriend. He was also a drug dealer. And so that whole next year, I dropped out of school, moved in with him. Well, he didn't really even have me move in. I just kind of never went home. He came actually from a nice family. His parents were very nice people. They owned a nice business. He had gone to, like, part of his high school had gone to, like, the Ivy League boys school, got kicked out for drinking. But, you know, they attempted to give him a nice life. And I really thought that if I could just marry him and be a part of his family and live in a nice area and have some kids and just make it all look good, that I'd be fine. So my Al-Anon disease kicked in. And he had other plans for that. I got pregnant not on purpose. And he absolutely wanted nothing to do with me if I was going to have the baby, all of that kind of stuff. And we were also, like, living with heroin addicts, and I had done a ton of mushrooms. And I decided, and he decided it would not be a good idea to continue with the pregnancy, so we ended it. And from that day on, the drinking wouldn't hold down any of those emotions anymore. I would try to drink, and it was just like I was sober. Eventually, we broke up, and I went to Austin, Texas for my last drink. Oh, and I'm working at a treatment center. That's the best part. Forgot about that part. I had gotten a job that year working at St. Luke's Behavioral Health Center in Phoenix as, like, on the adolescent and children's unit. So all the a lot of us partied, too. It's crazy. I would hear that from the kids all the time, that the counselors were all drunks because they all had more time than we did. But, you know, these young girls would be coming in on crystal meth and having to detox, and we were a high acuity hospital. So what that meant was we'd get kids that would attempt suicide, and they would come to us, or they had overdosed. We had a kid take a ton of hits of acid, and he just tripped for like 3 days until they were able to get placed actually in a longer-term facility. So I didn't, like, see recovery happen, but there was a woman in that, a Native American woman actually, in that meeting that had 25 years sober in that hospital, and she ran groups, and I swear I'd sit in that group, and I was kind of getting 12 steps sideways, you know? So anyway, so I'm working at this treatment center, living with a drug dealer, and I would come to work, and I was the only one without a DUI of my friends, so I was the designated drunk driver. And I would be shoving all the beer cans underneath my car seat because I was afraid that any of the nurses or other doctors would walk by my car, look in, and see all the beer bottles and beer cans, and that I'd get in trouble. So that was the dual life that I was living my last year. But it wasn't working. I started having these moments of clarity. I had had this spiritual awakening when I was 16. I told you this friend of ours died, and I started hearing this, like, I've got to quit. And started hearing it very strong. And I would be in dive bars. We love to drink in dive bars. And I would look around and be like, oh, my God, I can't be here. I just kept getting this feeling, I am in the wrong place. I'm on the wrong path. Like, this is everything about what I'm doing is not right, and it hasn't been for a long time. But I didn't know how to change it. And I went to Austin, Texas to drink. I had gone there the year before with my drinking buddy from ASU and had a great time. I mean, if you like music, Austin, Texas is the place to go. I mean, every place I went, it was like fantastic blues, fantastic music, great beer, you know, just like it was epic, you know. So I went on this trip hoping to just like kill my pain. That was like the idea, is to kill my pain. And I don't care how much beer I drank, it wouldn't go away. I turned into the crying drunk, and my friend was like, "You're a drag. You know, what is wrong with you?" And you know, I was scared. I really didn't know, because all these years it had worked. I could put something in and not care like that. You know, I could take a couple shots of tequila and it was good. I was good. And if you did a couple lines, it was even better, you know. And it was just like I could just be okay. It feel okay. And it wasn't working. I got on the airplane to fly home, and I swear the poor flight attendant had to think that my whole family died, because I sobbed so hard on the way home because I did not know what was going to happen to me. I really thought I was at the end, and I was. I was at the end of my drinking. And my stepmom picked me up, who my dad had married, this great lady. She saved us, really. She was such a sweet lady, and gave us a very normal life. And I told her, you know what, I don't know what it's going to be, but something has to change. And I don't remember why I thought of this, but it dawned on me that if I could get him sober, the drug dealer boyfriend, and get him to marry me, I really got stuck on that plan. So I went to the National Council for Alcoholism and told them all about my boyfriend. And this guy saw me coming a mile away, and he goes, "Well, let me tell you my story." And he sat there and told me he had 8 years sober, and that's all I remember. And he said, "If you really love your boyfriend, what you'll do is you will go to Al-Anon for 2 weeks, and you won't drink. And then you come back and see me, and we'll talk about an intervention." Now, let me tell you, if you're an alcoholic like me in Al-Anon without a drink, it is miserable. I love Al-Anon today. I think Al-Anon has saved my sobriety. I will talk about that in a minute, but not in early sobriety. And I was just like, these people do not know what they're talking about. And I went, I did what this guy said. I had had one beer in that 2 weeks. And I knew that if I could, and I didn't go anywhere, because I knew I couldn't go out with my friends. I couldn't go anywhere and not drink. I had been at someone's house watching basketball, trying to be normal, and somebody walked in with a six-pack of Löwenbräu, and I don't drink fancy beer like that. That was not my... And he said, they offered me a beer, and I told myself I'd have one, and I had one, and I knew I had to go home, because if I didn't, I was either going to drink it all and go home with that guy and start the whole thing over again, or I just needed to get away from people. I was at an Al-Anon meeting on a Saturday morning, and in walked this... It was just a miserable meeting. I just remember there was a guy. I have to tell you about this guy. His guy was laying on the floor. I hope this guy got better. I hope he was relieved of his pain. Man, those Al-Anons can feel. They don't get the numbing, you know, that we get. He was laying on the floor, curled up in the fetal position, crying. I just remember he was from France. So he was like, I couldn't understand him because he was speaking practically French, that his girlfriend had left him. I'm like, this is just not, you know, it was just a weird meeting. But anyways, in walked this guy who had a book under his arm, and he kind of looked like Neil Diamond a little bit. And just like the music references, it's just I only am going to be attracted to anything musical. But even Neil Diamond, I'm not a big Neil Diamond fan, but you know what I mean? It's all right. And made a lot of money in music. But and he came in with this little old lady, and he sat down, and he listened to everybody talk for a little bit. It was a teeny little meeting, and he started, when he raised his hand, he said, "You know, you all don't even know what you're doing." He goes, "Have you not seen the steps on the back? Have you not tried?" And I thought, this guy knows what the hell's going on. He's finally making sense to me. And he just tried to 12-step the whole meeting. He really needed Al-Anon, actually. That's why the lady brought him there, the Al-Anon brought him there. Well, after the meeting, I ran up to him, and I said, "I don't know. You are the only person I have found in here that seems to know what's going on. Can you send me to the bookstore to get the book on these 12 steps so I can work those steps, turn them in to whoever, and go on my way?" Because this, like, showing up in meetings and people crying on the floor is just not working, you know. And so he said, "Well, you know, why don't you come to breakfast with us?" You know, and I am so glad to this day I didn't say no, because if I would have said no, I would not be standing here today. And I paused. I remember pausing for a long time thinking, you know, Neil Diamond was not hip in 1994 on a Saturday night. You know what I mean? Saturday. And he had the look, but I'm like, you know, but he just made sense to me. And I said, okay, I'll go. And we went to like IHOP or something, and he sat there at the IHOP talking about alcoholics loud like that. And I'm like, can we not say that word so loud? I'm like, shh, bring it down. He's like, what are you afraid of? Someone might find out that I am an alcoholic. He so intrigued me. You know, I was just fascinated. Then he talked me into going over to this little lady's house and sitting on her back patio and smoking cigarettes. I think he bought me a pack of cigarettes. So I'm like, all right, I'll come. And so we sit there and he starts telling me a little bit about his life. He starts telling me a little bit about how, oh, and his name is Silver Dollar Jack, that he goes by Silver Dollar Jack. And the book that was under his arm was a big book, which he immediately pulled out at the, you know, restaurant and was reading. I was just like, what is this guy doing, you know? And Arizona's kind of like that. At least the meetings I went to, there were a lot of big book thumpers. That's what we call them there. Big book thumpers, you know, that pull out their book and you read the book, which it really helped me get a foundation. But it's not very socially acceptable, but, you know. So we sat there, and he shared about his life, about how his mom blew her brains out and how he found her. And I'm like, yeah, really? Well, you know what happened when I was 15? Because I didn't talk at all about what happened with those boys all the way until I moved into the nicer neighborhood. That just didn't exist. I said, well, you know what? I used to like smoke coke, you know, with these guys. And, you know, and I would tell them these things and tell them these horrible things that would happen. And he goes, yeah, normal 14, 15-year-old girls don't freebase. I'm like, really? Well, I did. Why would that not be normal? And he just kind of, he'd share a little bit more about him, and I'd share a little bit more about those parts. And but then I'd share a lot about my boyfriend needing to get sober. And he goes, he said to me, these were the magic words. He said, okay, well, do you think you have maybe a little drinking problem? And he's like, after all the stuff you just told me, you think you have a little drinking problem? I said, you know, maybe. I think I have a little, I might have a little drinking problem. He goes, yeah, it's kind of like being pregnant. You know, you don't have a little drinking problem. You either have one or you don't. He goes, honey, you cannot take a cucumber and make it a pickle and turn it back into a cucumber. And you are a pickle, aren't you? And it made sense to me. And I started crying. And I knew he was right. I knew he was right. Like, I had a drinking problem. And he, as soon as I admitted it, because I did, I admitted I had a drinking problem right then and there, he goes, oh, well, you know what? I'm going to take you to a new meeting. You've been in the wrong meeting. He got super excited for me. He told me how I was going to meet all my new friends in AA. He was going to take me to a meeting. I was going to have a life beyond my wildest dreams. He goes, you don't even know. Put your seatbelt on. You know, he had all those things. Put your seatbelt on. You're on the roller coaster ride of your life. You're going to meet all your new friends. So he takes me and this little lady who was 75, this little Al-Anon was along for the ride, you know. He took us to this fancy dinner and I'm in like cutoff shorts, you know. I'm like, my friends are all partying at ASU. I'm 23 years old. I'm with Neil Diamond and his mom, you know. And we get to the my first meeting and there's a guy with a patch. The guy leading it has got a patch over his eye. There's another guy with a patch over his eye. I don't get the patches. There was like a homeless woman and a big, you know, drunk Indian guy. And I started crying because these are not going to be my new friends when I'm 23 years old. And they gave 24-hour tokens out there. And they asked, does anybody want to get a 24-hour token? And I just sat there, and he elbowed me and said, that's you, honey. I said, I'm not going to get up in front of these people. And he goes, if you don't get up and get a 24-hour token, you're going to die drunk. I knew he was right. I just knew something like that was right. And so I got my token, sat down. I have not had a drink since then. I know. It's a miracle. Now, between then and now, there's been a shitload of work. You know what I mean? It wasn't it. I'd like to say, but my cousin who's in jail thinks that's it. That's why he's in jail. But, you know, It was, you know, he told me right away, you go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He said, you are so sick, you don't even know you're sick, honey, so I'm going to assign you a sponsor. And he did. He assigned me this great sponsor who was really the first person I trusted. I did my inventory with her. I did my steps with her. I didn't get into a relationship the first year. They really pushed that in Phoenix. We're a lot looser in California. But in Phoenix, they're like really on it. They're like just keep, you know, especially with young girls. They don't let a lot of that go down. And I didn't because I was waiting for that boyfriend to come back anyways. But which he did, actually, at 3.5 years sober. And I tried that again. It didn't work. And I moved to California in exactly a year after I got sober. And it's a magical story how I got here because I really wanted to come where there were young people sober. There's a huge, when I got sober, there was a huge young population of sobriety. And some of you guys are here. I love that. And there wasn't in Phoenix. I knew I needed to be by people like me, my age, who would relate to me. And so I had gotten fired my first year. Like, I had never even gotten fired. You know, the treatment center kept me drinking. You know what I mean? They fired me sober. And then, you know, I got this great restaurant job because, I mean, all these magical things happen. But to get here to San Diego, I really started, you know, I found a higher power. I found a higher power. And I was told, you know what? Do not worry about your job. Do not worry about where you're going to live. Right now, you just worry about getting sober and you just do the steps. And everything will be taken care of for you. And I will tell you, it was like I was picked up out of the ghetto and brought over here and dropped over there. If I would have had anything to do with it, I'd still be living in the ghetto. Because that's how my brain worked. I got to go work at this fancy restaurant. I had no experience that somebody in the meeting gave me a chance to come and work at this restaurant. I made a killing working there. Everybody drank on the job. I had to sit through wine tastings. I thought, there is no way I can do this job. My sponsor told me, yes, you can. We go anywhere sober. You pray before you go, and here's what you say. You tell them you're allergic to alcohol and you don't take a drink. You go to a meeting before you go to work. You call me when you get home. I never drank at that job. And I worked in a restaurant for years, serving margaritas, serving wines. It does not matter if we have a spiritual program. My buddy that I got when I got sober was a guy, because I didn't like women. Who likes women when they get sober, except for men, right? And I was told, though, so I was told by Silver Dollar Jack that the men in this program, when you get sober, honey, when you're young, they are going to just want to slap your ass. The women are going to want to save it. So you stick with the women. That's what he told me. So I did. I stuck, you know, with the women as far as my sponsor, and then I had guy friends, you know, and I didn't date anybody. And this guy got a job. I got fired from my job. I did not think I was going to get to come to San Diego. I really wanted to move here. I don't know why. I just did. I said a prayer. I said, God, you know what? If you need me to stay in Arizona, I will stay here. I promise I'll do whatever it is I'm supposed to do here, if that's what your will is. But you know I really want to go to San Diego. So, you know, I'm going to turn it over to you, but I'll be here and do your work. And 3 days later, my buddy called me and said, I just got a job as the salesperson for this art show in San Diego, and I get to hire everybody. Do you want to go? And I got to come here with a sober person, live with someone sober for the first 3 months I got here, and then I didn't have to go home. Then it went crazy, because then I was here with all the young people sober, and all those rules for the 1 year went out the window, and because I'm fixed at a year, you know. Moved in the boyfriend I knew for 3 weeks, even though my sponsor said not a good idea, you know, and just craziness, but didn't drink and had a ton of fun. You know, there was a lot of fun, a lot of craziness. My sponsor at about 2 years, because I was sure that I was never going to get married. I was sure I was never going to have kids. I had to go to outside help for that situation of assault with those young boys. I hit about 3 years of sobriety, and if I didn't do something about the pain that was coming up with that, I was going to get loaded, period. I had to go and seek outside help for that. I showed up to this meeting through a community center, sure that it wasn't going to be for me. In walked somebody from the program that I knew and sat down with the same problem. We went through that whole program together and worked the steps. Stuff like that just happened to me all the time. My sponsor told me I wouldn't be ready for a relationship until I was 5 years sober. I was pissed. I couldn't wait that long. So But she was right. And I met my husband when I was 6 years sober. I couldn't have met somebody like him with all the stuff I was carrying around. I needed time. It takes time in here to let all those hurts come up. And they still are coming up with the years I have sometimes. When I went through this outside help, I found that I had a gift I didn't know I had. And it was being a songwriter and a singer. I had no idea. I loved music, but I had no idea that was going to be a part of it. And it was really what got me through a lot of problems then. I wrote a lot of songs. I was lucky to live down the street from a coffee house in Ocean Beach where all the songwriters were hanging out at the time. And I'd hide in my room for hours, write my songs, walk down the street, get on stage and sing them, and I would feel better. And it was totally for me. Now it has turned out to be more for other people. I write, and I feel like it affects other people. It's been something that's evolved for me. I went to school. I got my degree as a teacher. I tried to do that. Didn't really like it very much, and that's okay. You know, the program teaches us we take care of ourselves, and we're true to ourselves. I met my husband when I was 6 years sober. He had 12 years of sobriety, and we were together for 4 years, got married. It hasn't always been hunky-dory. I feel like I work a much better program than he does. But I'll tell you this. Currently, we both are working a really good program. And when we are both working a good program, it is, like, amazing. We have a 6-year-old son. My dad died of this disease 3.5 years ago in a crack house. He was a functioning alcoholic up until the day that he went on disability. And just like in the book, the carpet slippers came out. He drank every day. Nobody wanted to watch him die, so he let crack and crystal meth dealers come live at his house so that he didn't have to die alone. And when I went to his house 3 years ago to clean it out, it was the best thing I could see of what will happen to me. I really should be. And he was in Apache Junction. I don't know if anybody knows about Apache Junction, Arizona, but it is like crystal meth capital of Arizona right now. And that's where he died. And that's where, if I would have continued drinking, I would have been with him. And, you know, my little boy, who's 6, he asked me, you know, why is Grandpa Tom gone? And we've been honest with him. Because he's allergic to alcohol, and he didn't know it, and he drank too much of it, and it killed him. And that's the truth. And what happens, because I have that allergy, is if I drink it, and I keep drinking it, it's going to kill me. And my son asks me all the time, who's 6, oh, it just kills us. So do I have the allergy too? And we're like, well, I don't know. You know, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, I go to Salvation Army, too. I'm going to just end with this, that one of the things that I've done in my sobriety that my sponsor made me do, and I did not want to do it, was service. And she was the coordinator at Salvation Army, and she made me come once a month. I've been doing it for about 10 years. And once a month I go in there and I meet with these moms. A lot of them are moms, and their babies are taken from them. They're just out of jail, and they get better. And to see that progress happen and to know that our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety is it. And if I can do that, I'm doing far more for this, for myself, my family, and everybody around me than I ever could imagine. So thanks for listening, you guys. Right on.